A special welcome for Franklin High School students. Would they please stand?
Oh my goodness.
They be seated. These students are here with us on a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's a national award-winning program. And high schools across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If the high school agrees, the students are sent briefs, and they may engage in various activities relating to this case. They come for an oral argument, and then we'll meet with the justice at noon to discuss the procedures that the court uses in selecting and hearing and deciding cases. The substantive issues in the case will not be discussed. Everyone is welcome to come to that session after the second oral argument in this case. So let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Rogensack, who will meet with the students today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice David Process, and on the far left, Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. And we also have another special guest with us. And that is Attorney Rosenthal and Mrs. Rosenthal, who are the parents of my law clerk. And we welcome them from California, and he's going to run the marathon in Chicago this weekend. Let us wish him good luck. With those introductions made, we will now turn to our first case, 04-AP-07-67, Robin K. versus Lamanda M. Arguing on behalf of Robin K. is Alan J. White. Mr. White.
Chief Justice Abramson and Associate Justices, as Chief Justice indicated, I'm Alan White of Helen Law Offices in Wisconsin Dells. And I represent the appellant in this appeal, Robin K. The essential question that's going to be faced by the court in deciding this case is whether or not the guardianship statute requires a finding of parental unfitness before the guardianship can be granted to a third person over a parent. First, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the practical considerations that we run into, those of us practicing law every day out in the private sector, with regard to guardianship. Sometimes they will be imposed or in place where parties in jail or incarcerated, where probation might inhibit or have a restriction on contact with a particular child. A person might be, I had personally a case where the person was an alcoholic in a drug rehab facility, and the grandmother had been granted guardianship. The list of reasons for guardianship could go on quite extensively, I believe. And typically, I found that many of the judges where I practice in the small town of Wisconsin Dells, but I practice in five different counties, many times the courts will impose time limits or time frames on the actual guardianship. That seems to be a question that's sometimes pretty hot. And Judge Evenson, in this case, had asked the guardian ad litem if he could impose any restrictions. And Mr. Reitz had indicated, the guardian ad litem had indicated that he didn't believe he could, but I think that, as I stated in our brief, I believe that the court can impose restrictions in a guardianship matter, such as time limits.
Counsel,
yes, Judge.
And it's bothering me. What is the relationship between the natural parent and the child? I mean, your opposing counsel indicates that there's a, you're talking about a fundamental right of a parent. And In this case, I know that the child had lived with the great aunt for at least 2.5 years. I know that the parent perhaps had some difficulties. There were other children, et cetera. But what relationship, what, quote, strike that, what right is there? What a parent and a child, and here we have a great aunt who wants to become, who wants to have a guardianship set up. So what relationship is there between the parent and the child?
Well, Justice Wilcox, I believe that the parent has a fundamental right to the care and...
So if there's a fundamental right, then to overcome that, that's what this case is about, right? It's about the best interest versus fitness.
And yes, Justice Wilcox, I'd agree with that, yes.
So excuse me.
Go ahead.
So your argument seems to be, and I don't know, where did fitness come into this case? Where did the fitness of the mother, was that an issue?
The fitness of the mother came into the case. We never claimed that the mother was unfit in bringing the...
So if the mother isn't unfit, then what are you saying, that it's in the best interest of the child, regardless of whether she is a good or bad mother, that this guardianship should look at that standard?
Not if it's in context of a good or bad mother. Our position in this case was that the fact that the mother had turned the child over, at least for some period of time, to the great aunt, that she herself recognized that she was not up to the task at that particular time to take care of the child adequately. And then the unfitness standard was infused into the case by the trial court, because it felt, as Judge Evenson said in his decision, that we had to look at this case should not have been brought under the guardianship statute. In his opinion, it was more appropriately under the custody statute. Again, we disagree with that position.
Could I ask, the child was with the aunt, in fact. What was motivating the petition for guardianship? What if that had been achieved, what would have been, what powers would the aunt have had, or what rights, or what would have been different?
Well, Justice Prosser, first of all, the great aunt was traveling, as we've indicated in the brief as well. The child was traveling to the West Coast with the great aunt. We had a situation where we felt that the aunt needed to, I'm going to use aunt instead of great aunt, but we felt that the aunt needed to have some rights to exercise in the event that a health issue were to arise, and so that was of great importance to us. The child was placed with the aunt voluntarily, as we've indicated, and we felt that it was necessary to get some legitimacy to that placement.
Now, you're not asking us to overrule the Barstad case, isn't that right?
Absolutely not.
You recognize that at least this state has said that the care, that the custody of a child is a fundamental interest protected by the Constitution.
There's no question about that, Justice Abramson, no.
All right. Now, the guardianship statute says that a guardian has the care and custody of the child, right? So what's the difference? Then what's the difference between a guardian and a custodian, where the guardian has custody of the child under the statute?
Well, the difference between a guardian and a custodian is a very, I believe, fine line under the custody statute.
Can you find it?
Well, I think I can, I'm going to try and define it in this way. If we were to look at cases in this state, we have had cases that have looked at, for example, just the recent case of the termination of the parental rights to Diana P. That was a TPR case. And in that particular case, this court held that the statute itself, the CHIPS statute basically, eventually allowed for a termination of parental rights. And it allowed for termination of parental rights because the parent, through the stages that are contained in the CHIPS statute, was found to be unfit. Importantly, and extremely importantly, in my estimation, is the fact that 48.424 mentions the word fit in it. And also, we also have fitness and unfitness that come up in the context of family law cases under 767.
How does that help you in your case, which doesn't talk about fitness?
It helps us, I believe, in this sense. I believe there are three statutes that affect parents' rights with their children. There's the CHIPS statute.
And there's no CHIPS here.
There's no CHIPS here. Okay. But I believe that when you look...
Any present CHIPS?
No, there is not. There's not a present CHIPS. When you look at the family law statute, 767.24, it also mentions the term fit. It's in there. But when we get to the guardianship statute, there is no mention anywhere of fitness, unfitness, or any nature whatsoever. As the court will recall, in the termination of Diana P., the court ruled that it was the period of years or times that the parent had been warned, and then the fact that the statute did provide a fitness determination or unfitness determination.
Okay. And
those,
yes. We're under the guardianship.
Yes.
You're not proposing that the guardianship statute be used as an end run against TPR, right?
I'm not proposing it.
Right.
But I think it's a possibility, and I have thought about this very seriously in the months, the year that this case has gone on. The possibility is there because if the parent remains out of the home for a year, then they might come under the other statute.
That's right. But if they come under a TPR because of abandonment or because of CHIPS or one of the others, then you think that 880 should be used in lieu of this entire statutory procedure that the legislature has set forth on CHIPS and TPR? That's really my question. Can you end run those statutes?
I don't think you can end run those statutes. I don't think that the courts should allow you to end run those statutes. I think that this, that our judicial system has set up in a hierarchy. And in Barstow versus Frazier, this court had said, basically, that there was a difference between, a fundamental difference between a TPR and a custody because of the rights you were extinguishing in the TPR versus the custody statute. Now, I would go one step further. I have always viewed, and I've been practicing now for 23 years, I've always viewed the guardianship as being somewhat lesser of a standard because of the necessity for it to be used in the frequency that it's used and the frequency that I've used it in my practice.
Well, let me just look at 880.03. We're dealing with a statute. All minors are subject to guardianship, right?
Yes, that's right.
And this child is a minor.
That's correct.
Okay. The court may appoint a guardian of the person, of anyone subject to guardianship, and we don't have a problem of residence, etc., under extraordinary circumstances requiring medical aid. We're not saying that there's any requirement of medical aid here, right?
No, we are not.
Okay. Under extraordinary circumstances requiring the prevention of harm to his or her person. So is that what you come under? You have to come under something here.
Well, what we have come under, what we tried to show to the trial court was, number one, that the mother, and the trial court expressed concerns, as you know from his decision, that there was concerns about the mother's home and family, and that the child had been turned over to the aunt voluntarily, and we were seeking to have that legitimized.
So is that the extraordinary circumstances, and where is the prevention of harm? Did you prove that?
Did we prove it? We did not. We did not prove that the child was being harmed. We did show, and we did have evidence that the child may have been in a harmful situation. And the guardian ad litem, Your Honor, did indicate that there was akin to abandonment in the case, that there was much concern on his part about the care of the child. And so I would say that that is a part of what we're looking at. Now, I want to mention another thing about the guardianship statute, and that is this. The guardianship statute does not require personal service. If the notice of the hearing on the guardianship is mailed out, it says that the under minors 8808, when the proposed minor's notice shall be given as provided in 87905, and 87905 indicates that as long as the notice is mailed out received 20 days prior to the hearing, and in my estimation, the importance of that is that the personal service, when we're terminating someone's rights, when we're bringing a person into court, trying to take custody from them, that requires them to be personally put on notice. But the guardianship statute does not require that. And again, it falls then, in my estimation, into this hierarchy where we have a termination of parental rights, custody, and then guardianship. And the service statute indicates, in my opinion, that it should be, that it's a lesser intrusion.
What's the test that the trial judge is supposed to apply here in determining whether or not to grant guardianship to a third person, not a parent, where the parent is objecting?
Your Honor, we have proposed throughout the case that we, number one, must look at the statute. And the statute talks about suitability. And the cases that we've cited, albeit some of them old, and the appellee has cited some older cases as well, and that's obviously why we should be here, but we believe the standard is the suitability of the parent.
And you believe that that's a lesser test than fitness?
Yes, I do believe that.
Is there any basis for that?
One of the bases for it would be that fitness is not mentioned in anywhere in the guardianship statute, so that it would be, the legislature could have used that term if they'd have wanted to use it. They've used it in the other two statutes that I've talked about earlier. And so I believe, and it's a lesser standard, as I mentioned, because of the fact of the notice to be given to the parents and other interested parties.
But now you're getting the word suitability, as I understand it, under 880.09 paren 2. Isn't that correct? Isn't that where you find it?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. Yes.
And yet, when you read that statute, it doesn't seem to apply, at least to me, to this kind of situation. It talks about if one or both of the parents of a minor are suitable and willing, the court shall appoint one or both of them. I'm not sure I understand how that relates to the third person, which is what we're dealing with here.
Well, the only answer I can give you, Justice Crooks, on that is this, and that is that placement of the child had been given to the aunt by the mother. Problems can arise in that situation. The law should make some provision for health. The law makes provision in the guardianship statute for selection of guardians. We did not feel that the mother was appropriately managing and handling the child, and presented evidence on that issue to Judge Evenson. And he assumed, for purposes of argument in that hearing, that there had been this 2.5-year period that the aunt had a pretty much placement of this child.
Why didn't you debate on that? I thought the mother debated whether the aunt really had it for 2.5 years.
Yes, Chief Justice Anderson, she did contest that, and the Judge Evenson, though, assumed for argument purposes that that was in fact true.
Did not decide that issue.
No, he didn't. And I do take issue with the appellee's brief in that respect. I don't believe that he decided that issue.
Mr. White, if I could follow up on Justice Crook's question. I'm also looking at 8809 sub 2. And Justice Crook's mentioned how the statute applies to give a preference for, in fact, mandates preference for the parents, unless there's an objection by the ward. But am I missing something? Where in the statute does it set forth any standard for transferring custody away from the parent? In other words, it says this is, if the parent is suitable and willing, the parent gets guardianship, but it doesn't say how you take guardianship away or take custody away. Do you understand my question?
Yes, I do. I believe that the guardianship statute in and of itself, concerning the whole statute, makes provisions for transferring guardianship away from a parent to other parties, because it mentions earlier in the statute.
But if I could, because I want to focus on the statute here, where does it say that a parent loses the ability to have custody of a child if they're unsuitable? What you lose is the preference. But where does it say that the parent loses custody?
I don't think it says anything about the parent losing custody there, Justice Butler.
Well, what about 8803, which I keep talking about, that when the court may appoint a guardian of the person is when there are extraordinary circumstances requiring the prevention of harm to the child's person. We're not dealing with property at the moment. So why doesn't that tell you when you can set up a guardianship under extraordinary circumstances requiring prevention of harm?
Well, we feel there was extraordinary circumstances here.
But does that tell you when a guardian can be appointed?
I think it could be read that way, yes.
What other way can you read it?
I don't think there's any other way to read it.
Okay. So your response to Justice Butler is you've got to fall under 8803.
You have to, along with, I think, taking the guardianship statute in its entirety.
Okay. So, and what are the extraordinary circumstances here? That she left the child and it's been 2.5 years and that she's not a great mother?
That's correct. She did not leave the child. She left the child with an aunt. She was still in proximity to the child, and the child did visit with her as well.
But there's no suitability requirement in 8803, is that correct?
In 8803, Judge, I don't have that in front of me, but I'll take your word for it. But I do believe, though, that the suitability is the goal to word in the statute. And I believe that we've got to look, we're getting close to the end here as far as my presentation is concerned. I do believe that it's important for this court to look at what the legislature has done. They've had many, many years of decisions that have talked about fitness in some guardianship cases, as Attorney Campbell pointed out in her brief, but never was fitness put into the guardianship statute the way it was in the other two statutes.
What troubles me in what I'm in listening to the questions of my colleagues and your answers, what are the rights of the parent? Where do they just say that there was a voluntary guardianship and because of travel she wanted, if there was an accident she wanted this child to be covered, and then all of a sudden the parent wanted the child back. She didn't want the guardianship. Do we have, what I'm imagining is if we take your road, what does the parent have to do once the guardianship is established? I mean, that's a concern. And if you had no fight here at all, and the parent said, yes, oh, yes, I want a guardianship, you're going to California, and I want this child to be covered so that you can go and get medical care if needed. And then there's a decision not to, she says, now I'd like him or her back. What's the fundamental, what right does the parent have? I think some of my colleagues are struggling with that. When you go under the statute and you say it's all-inclusive and for extraordinary circumstances, but it seems alien to the thought that there is this fundamental right, and once you interfere with that, if we were to say, yes, we'll go ahead and grant you this but I think we're getting in an area that it is not entirely clear. And what do you think the parent can do?
Justice Wilcox, 18 years ago, I argued a case before this court, and it was regarding a guardianship that had been in effect for 7 years. And we were up in Adams County, and Justice Geringer ended that guardianship with about a 15-minute hearing as far as the mother was concerned. The mother came into court. She'd given up the child to was an aunt in that circumstance. And the case is in the interest of DMM. And I think that the only thing that a parent would have to show is that that parent is suitable now to take care of the child. I don't think you've got a custody situation where a certain proof has to be brought about. I don't think you have TPR, it's not even an issue. But I think suitability, and it is a lower standard.
Counsel, as I read your brief, and you focus on suitability under 880.09 sub 2, and then you say, okay, let's define suitability. And as I read your brief, you really define suitability as what's in the best interest of the child for purposes of 880.09 sub 2. Am I correct or incorrect with regard to my interpretation of how you define suitability?
You're correct.
Okay. In looking at this case, and I find this case very difficult, and in following the Barstead case and site-checking the Barstead case, we have a more recent case, or the Court of Appeals has a more recent case that seems almost right on point. And it is a 1995 case, and it's much like the fact situation that Justice Wilcox was just talking about, where you had a woman give the case, by the way, is Howard M. versus Gene R., cited at 196 with second 16. It wasn't cited by any party in this case. But you have a young girl giving the guardianship to Howard, who I think is the brother-in-law, and then by consent, but then wanting it back. And that was his fact situation. And this is what the court says, and I think you have a hard row to hoe with this decision. It says, the reason, however, that the Barstead court concluded that a parent is entitled to the custody of his or her child, absent unfitness or compelling circumstances, turned on the constitutionally protected right of a parent to the custody of his or her child. That is why the standard for governmental interference in the relationship is higher than the best interest of the child test. Seems to me you're arguing in direct contravention that your test is the best interest of the child, but that is in contravention of the more recent case cited here, 1995. How do you respond to that, if you are able to?
First of all, I have not read the case. I haven't even, I have not cited it. I don't think either party has cited it. But the only response I would make at this point, Justice Bradley, is this, and that is that I believe that the parent has a very fundamental right. But Barstad very specifically says that is not something that they get gratis. And if the parent, for some reason, has abdicated that right or given that right over to someone else, that then the full constitutional protections of the United States Constitution, and I would presume the Wisconsin Constitution, do not come into play. Now, I know, I'm in a red light here, but I'd like to just continue just for a moment. I think you've got to look at that as, I don't want to create a tier here where the first issue of the guardianship is the parent entitled to the full constitutional guarantees because he or she has not given up some of these rights by not being involved with their child. However, that may very well be the case, because the Barstow is very clear in that it states that if the parent has abdicated their responsibilities, that the full constitutional guarantees under the United States Supreme Court cases, Stanley versus Illinois and others, do not come into play.
Counselor, I have one more question that I didn't get to ask, even though your light is on. My question to you is this. If we send it back to the trial court as you ask, do we instruct the trial court to make a finding under 880.09 sub 3 that there are or there are not extraordinary circumstances requiring prevention of harm to the child in this case, as well as using suitability instead of unfitness as the standard?
I think to satisfy the statute, we would have to I believe if it were sent back to the trial court, that we would have to show suitability would be the standard, but that there would be some extraordinary circumstances in the case under 880.03.
Right, but it lists what those extraordinary circumstances are, and one of them is medical needs of the child, and you told us that wasn't at issue here, and then the other one is, out of the statute, requiring prevention of harm to the child. So it's not just that the child might be in a better spot with the aunt, is the basic standard to start with. And I guess I'm wondering, do you see that as a finding for the trial court or not?
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of the question.
Do you see that as a necessary finding for the trial court as part of any determination that is made on a request for guardianship contrary to a parent's wishes?
Yes, I do.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney representing the mother, Catherine Campbell.
Thank you. I'm here today. My name is Catherine Campbell. I'm with the law firm of LaRoe, Gerlach & Roy in Reedsburg, Wisconsin, and I represent Lamanda M. in this case. I did want to advise the court, although I think it's clear from the transcript from Judge Evenson's decision, that I was not involved at the trial court level. So Attorney White would have a better handle on what occurred at the trial court level than I would have. Although I've talked, obviously, to my client and read the transcripts and spoken with Attorney White, quite frankly. I have a concern here. I practice a lot of family law. I do some guardianship work. The focus of my practice is in family law. And I have a concern that Chapter 767 can be circumvented by just filing a guardianship action. In our case, Chapter 880 allows any interested person to ask for a guardianship. An interested person is defined as an adult relative or friend of the person to be protected. That can be a lot of different people, and it can invite a lot of people to step into a case who might not otherwise step into that case. Once the guardian is appointed, that guardian has the care, custody, and control of that child. Presumably, as Justice Wilcox brought up, that guardian can remove the child to another state for a vacation, can get medical care for the child, can put the child in school, relocate to a different school district or different school area without consulting the parent, and even over the parent's objection, if you take what Attorney White is proposing, is accurate. That's a real concern for me. Now, there's a preference, obviously, in the statute, as you've already indicated, that if the parent is suitable and willing, that parent should have custody. The question here is
the guardian.
I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't hear you.
The parent be the guardian.
Yes, ma'am. The parent should be the guardian. Yes. The question here is the definition of suitable, at least as Attorney White has raised in his brief, the definition of suitable vis-a-vis a parent and a third party. Now, I understand Section 8803 talks about extraordinary circumstances and getting medical care, preventing harm, and medical care. But if we have the question becomes, what exactly is it are you proving? Are you proving that the parent is suitable? Does the parent have to come in and say, in a guardianship action gets filed, does the parent have to come in and say, I am a suitable parent? And the third party has to now prove that the parent is unsuitable. The question then becomes, what is that? Yes, sir.
Counsel, it seemed to me guardianships apply in case of minors and in cases of certain disability and spendthrifts. And I mean, there's a broad array. It would seem to me that the first element that ought to be proved before the court considers whether to appoint a guardian of the person is, are there extraordinary circumstances that justify this?
I agree.
If you don't have extraordinary circumstances, why would you fight about whether it's a parent or an aunt or another, a friend?
And I agree.
Okay. Well, let me ask this. The aunt had sort of de facto custody, at least placement.
That fact was disputed.
The aunt had the child for a long time. It was caring for the child. Could she have accomplished her desire to have authority, say, to authorize an operation or get medicine or anything to do with health care in some way other than a guardianship? Could the mother have simply said, I authorize so-and-so to Robin so-and-so to blah, blah?
That was the question I was going to ask you. Are you talking specifically to this case or are you talking in general?
In general. Can you do it just by an ordinary document?
I would think that if the aunt has de facto custody, as you stated, and there is not a guardianship, that the aunt, there's nothing, as far as I can tell, based on your scenario, preventing the aunt from going back to a parent, one of the two parents, depending on how custody is set up, in asking for permission and either having the parent give permission directly to the health care provider or providing some sort of written consent to the health care provider. And I'm recalling some instance that we had, or that I had years ago, where there was a situation where a grandparent had the placement of the child and the child needed some sort of medical care, and the parent wrote out a statement and he provided it to the medical providers, and it was accepted by them at that time. It wasn't serious.
Would there be, in effect, a health care power of attorney for a child?
That's an interesting question. My answer is I'd have to check the statute on the health care powers of attorney to see whether that would apply in the situation or not. I'm unfamiliar with that as it applies to this context.
If the person has legal custody of a child, does the power to control health care decisions attend to legal custody?
I believe it does, and it can be, but you can limit legal custody. Legal custody can be limited as between two parents that they have joint legal custody, but one parent has the authority to authorize medical care if for one reason or another one parent is not able to do that.
So the reason I ask is because
as I was preparing for this case, I kept on thinking, as the trial court apparently did, why this isn't really a 767 custody case. There's a specific provision, of course, in 767 dealing with relatives wanting custody. And I'm not talking about generic third parties. I'm in 767.24 sub 3, custody to agency or relative. And it says, you know, under 1, if the interest of any child demands it and the court finds that neither parent is able to care for the child adequately, the court may declare the child to be in need of protection and services. Now, this is under 767.24.3, actions affecting the family, and transfer the legal custody to the relative. I'm skipping over the words agency because that's also involved there. I mean, so I say bingo, bango, bongo. I mean, isn't this the vehicle for when an aunt, relative, wants custody because in the interest of the child it is demanded and the court finds neither parent is able to care for the child adequately? I thought that's right what we have here in terms of assertions anyway.
Yes, Your Honor, and I can't say why it was brought as a guardianship as opposed to a 767 action. I would note, too, that 767.24 sub 3 talks about if the interest of the child demands it, and if the court finds that neither parent is able to care for the child adequately or that neither parent is fit or proper to have the care and custody of the child, that there can be referred on a CHIPS action or given to a relative. I, in my practice, have never had that come up, thankfully, but so I agree with you that the aunt could have, and in my opinion should have, brought this as a 767 action. One purpose of bringing as a guardianship action that I could see would be to avoid having to deal with the higher burden in the statute and in Barstead.
I'm not sure it's all that higher of a burden because there's the disjunctive. When I didn't quote the unfitness portion because it's in the disjunctive or unfitness. I mean, it seems to me it's if the interest of any child demands it and the court finds that neither parent is able to care for the child adequately. You could proceed under that. Or if you want to take a greater bite, or that neither parent is fit and proper to have care and custody, which I think is higher than the best interest in adequate care, arguably. But that's in the disjunctive.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying. And I guess my question then becomes the definition of the word adequate in that circumstance.
That's right. That's exactly it.
And if you look at the Barstead, it talks about other compelling reasons at which point in time you do get to the best interest of the child standard if you can prove other compelling reasons, such as abandonment or neglect of parental duties. In this particular case, once again, not having been there at the trial court, the judge assumed certain things. And one of the things the judge assumed was that, for the sake of argument, was that the aunt had substantial time with the child. That, of course, was contested by the mother. I find it interesting that both the trial court said that he found no evidence of neglect in this particular case, and the guardian ad litem was the one who said that the abandonment statute may have been met somewhat. I think those were his exact words. So there appears to be some sort of dispute as between there was no dispute. It appears to me that there was no abandonment at this particular time and there was no neglect. In fact, the trial court indicated that although there may have been some shortcomings in LaManda's residence, that social services had offered services to her and that they hadn't removed any of the children from her residence.
How do you define under extraordinary circumstances requiring the prevention of harm to his or her person? Do you think circuit court has to make a finding about that? And that has to be proof by the person seeking guardianship?
I heard that as two questions, ma'am. I heard one is, what do I think it is, and then does the court have to prove it?
Does have the guardian, the person petitioning the guardianship, have to prove it?
I believe that extraordinary circumstances, to me, would be you could equate that with the compelling reasons under Barstead, abandonment, persistent neglect of parental duties, you know, failure to support, that kind of thing. If the parent drops a child off with a relative, or if a parent is in jail and cannot care for the child, that would be extraordinary circumstances in my mind. We have done guardianships in the past where one parent is unavailable because of incarceration, for example. That would be an extraordinary circumstance in my mind. So it could be more than just the parent's not abandoning the child on purpose, but unavailable.
And who has to prove that?
The person seeking the guardianship, in my mind.
Was that proved here? Did the trial court make findings about that?
No, they did not. In fact, the judge said that he didn't find anything neglect in the home.
Why shouldn't we send this back for the trial court to make findings under 8803 and take additional testimony and other evidence if needed?
My answer to that question, ma'am, is that I think the court has adequately done that. In its decision, the trial court said there's nothing specific of neglect to any of the children. He doesn't make any findings specifically on the abandonment issue, which has, at least under the CHIP statute, a fairly specific definition. But the court in this particular case, on the last page of its transcript here, said there are some general allegations of neglect. However, there's nothing specific of neglect to any of the children. And so I think the court has, in this particular instance, the trial court has already made the decision that there aren't any extraordinary circumstances. He voiced some concerns with regards to LaManda's household, but didn't find anything requiring a guardianship or even a referral to anywhere else.
What do you expect this court to write in this opinion? I assume you want them to affirm the Court of Appeals. So what kind of decision should come out of this court?
What I would like to see would be an affirmation of the Court of Appeals, first of all. But second of all, I would like to see a decision that says it gives a standard by which a third party can get a guardianship over a natural parent.
Under 8809-2?
Yes, under 8809. Yes, ma'am.
How come you skip over 8803?
I don't think you can, ma'am. I think it's a combination of both. And I'll give you an example. I was involved in a guardianship action up in Columbia County, and as this was just a couple of weeks ago while this case was pending, and it was once again represented the natural parent, and a friend had brought an action for a 17-year-old girl. And in a conference with the court to set the hearing time, I advised the court that this case was pending, and told him what the issues were, and he said he was going to want copies of the briefs. And one of the, because I asked him before we started, what's the standard we're working off of here? And the answer I got was best interest of the child. And so I then explained to the court, the trial court, that this action was pending and there were all these cases and he wanted the briefs. Well, unfortunately, we never got that far. Well, fortunately for the family, we never got that far. We ended up resolving the matter prior to the hearing and postponing the hearing. I would like to see an explanation because I'm getting from trial courts, and I've asked up friends and other attorneys and people, and you ask them what the standard is, and you get different answers. It's the Barstead standard. It's the best interest of the child standard. It's all over creation, depending on who you ask at any particular time and who's had experience with what courts.
Counselor, do you agree that the trial court decided this under Chapter 767 rather than 880?
Do I believe Judge Evenson did that?
Yeah.
It's difficult for me to say because I wasn't there, so I didn't hear all of the evidence. But
that's what you've read.
Yes, ma'am. Based on what I've seen, I would tend to believe that Judge Evenson did apply 767 standards to the 880 case. That's my understanding based on what I've read. Thank you.
Counsel, let me nuance that a bit and see if you agree or disagree. The way that I read the ruling of the judge is that he said this cannot be brought under 880. There are no standards set in 880. There are no procedures set in 880. And indeed, this is, and you made some reference to 767 as I recall, but I guess I saw the emphasis not that you have to bring this case under 767, but more that this is, but he did refer to it, suggesting it is a 767 case, but the emphasis was that this is not an 880 case, and you can't use 880 as a vehicle. Now, correct me if I'm wrong with regard to what the court said, or feel free to disagree with my interpretation on that. Do you think I'm right or wrong?
I think you were correct. I think that Judge Evenson expressed a lot of concerns. I'm reading, he's saying in his transcript here, if the guardianship is granted, how does it come to an end? Which is a concern that I have. There's nothing to guide the court in how it addresses whether the guardianship should end. It talks about setting conditions under a CHIPS action. I agree with you that the court would have probably preferred to see this as a custody action rather than a guardianship action.
Could I ask if custody were given to someone like the aunt, under 767.24.3, or if a guardianship had been given to the aunt, which would be easier to change when the parent came in? I mean, is it exactly the same, or is it more difficult under a custody case?
I would harken back to 767.24 sub 3 and what the definition of adequate is and whether that's the same as suitable. Because under Attorney White's analysis, he says that once a parent becomes suitable, that the parent can ask for custody back. The question then becomes, once a parent under 767.24 sub 3 becomes adequate, the parent then can bring a motion, presumably, and ask for placement back. So one of the concerns I have is that you're placing now the burden is back on the parent as opposed to the third party to show why the parent should have his or her own child back. And in a presumably adversarial proceeding, you would have the third party coming in and saying, well, wait, you're not suitable or you're not adequate yet. And in this particular case where the parent is of limited means, that can involve, you know, retaining a lawyer, although Lamanda did an adequate job, I think, herself in the trial court level. I think that it places an extra burden on the parent to get what I think we've all agreed is a constitutional right, and that is the custody of his or her child.
Counsel, I don't have it before me, but it seems to me if you're talking about 767.24 sub 3, that is custody determinations, that's probably subject to modification of the statute that's entitled, that I don't have in front of me, modification of custody under 767. I mean, there's such a statute that says modification of custody awards under 767, and it has something to do with the 2-year period and all that sort of stuff, and
Does it require a change of circumstances?
Under 767.24 sub 3, I would read that yes, it would require a substantial change in circumstances.
Well, but if she's now suitable or adequate, that is a change of circumstances.
Presumably, yes.
That's my point. I think that in response to Justice Prosser's question, you probably, although I don't know, you probably follow the modification of custody statute in 767, which requires a substantial change in circumstances.
And I don't have that particular statute in front of me either, Justice, but one of the this raises another concern, and it's a very good one, that if you go under the change in custody statutes, Justice Abramson brought this up just a second ago, does that mean that you're going to have within the 2-year period that the parent now has to show substantial evidence of harm to the child or something like that to get the kid back? The other question would be, assuming they say no, that doesn't apply, is there now the presumption that, because under 767.325, I don't have the subsection, I'm sorry, there's a presumption that the current placement of the child is in the child's best interest, and the person who brings the motion has to overcome that presumption.
That's 9/10 of the law, I think.
So that creates all kinds of problems in my mind. the first problem I have with it is the fact that it puts the burden back on the parent to go through the financial and potentially emotional problems of having to bring a motion to get their own child back and prove that they are not suitable.
From what I understand of your response, the answer to Justice Pross's question would seem to be that it might be more difficult to upset a custody decision than a guardian decision. Therefore, I'll just extend that, seems to be that the mother's interest, therefore, should be that a guardian should be imposed rather than a custodial situation be imposed, because it'll be easier for her to get the child back.
Depending on how you define the word suitable.
Counsel, one of the things that concerns me is the ramifications of this case, the end runs that we've been talking about. And I note there's been discussion about 880.03 here today in the arguments. I also note that that statute wasn't cited by your opposing counsel at all, and that you cited it only peripherally in a different context. So it concerns me. It seems like the operative language for purposes of today's discussion is what constitutes extraordinary circumstances requiring the prevention of harm to his or her person. Now, that language frightens me, because what's extraordinary to me may be mundane to you, and it is so subjective that I would be a little concerned about proceeding without any issue like that briefed or argued or raised by the parties. That gets me back to my question. What do you see are the ramifications, if any, if in an action such as this is allowed to proceed under 880? Are there any ramifications?
If an action such as this was allowed to proceed under 880 using the best interest of the child, I'm sorry, ma'am, you lost me.
Okay, when I say such as this, I mean under the facts of this case, and I mean when you have a parent who placed the child with a third party for a period of time, where you don't have any, at least as I saw the briefs and the part of the record that I read, no defined allegations of harm other than instability. Instability was the cornerstone for the guardian ad litem's recommendation. And so if you want to define that as harm to the person, but I'm not sure instability is harm to the person as envisioned under the statute. So are there, you practice a lot, what if we say, okay, that third parties can get guardianship in the kind of facts like you have here, 880. What, is that a problem? Are there ramifications to that, or is that just okay? Tell me what the consequences are.
Under the facts of this case, no, I don't think it's okay.
And then why not?
And the reason why not, I don't, is because if you can avoid going to the family court, a couple of concerns. First of all, if you file for a custody action under, if a third party can file for a custody action under 767.24 sub 3, and they can try to prove the child, the parent is not adequate, whatever that word
may mean. But it's two-part test. You keep on jumping over that. First of all, it's in the interest of any child demands it, so you've got the best interest test or the interest of the child, and if the court finds that neither party is able to care for the child adequately. So you got two things there.
Correct, Your Honor, I agree. And so my concern is that if it's going to be easier to go to 880 and file a guardianship action and say the fact that the child has resided with me off and on for the last 2.5 years, that constitutes extraordinary circumstances, that's a concern for me. Because it's not high enough, and I think you're going to have a whole bunch of people, rather than trying to go under 767, with a much higher burden, all of a sudden going into 880, and you're going to get an upswing in Chapter 880 guardianship cases with the parent, a grandparent, for example, coming in and saying, well, the parent can't offer the home, or the home is not adequate, in my opinion, and so or it's not suitable, to use Attorney White's wording here. So therefore, I'm going to ask for a guardianship. And I think the case law is clear that you don't, just because a parent isn't as well off as a wealthier, older person, that person ought to get guardianship or custody, in this particular case, a guardianship action.
It would seem to me, though, that if the test is unfitness, that's the test for terminating parental rights. It seems to me that the test for a guardianship has to be somewhat less than the same thing for termination of parental rights. Otherwise, why wouldn't you terminate? If the parent is unfit, why wouldn't somebody be trying to terminate their rights?
I don't know if I agree with you, and the reason I say that is because under the Barstead case, it's clear that to take a child away from a parent can have the same effect as a termination because you lose that relationship. As far as having a lower standard, I don't agree with you there. I think you have to have a standard the same as, because that could be that the net effect is that the parental relationship is terminated without the much larger proceedings of a termination of parental rights, where you've got jury trials and a lot greater expense, quite frankly. I mean, I practice in a small county with Attorney White. It's not like there's tons of money flying around here. A lot of the people that we deal with don't have these kinds of resources to bring. I've worked in adoption cases where we want to terminate the parental rights of the other parent so a step-parent can adopt. The other parent refuses to do it. They won't do it voluntarily. Now, I have to tell my client, this is what the process is to involuntarily terminate someone, and they're entitled to a jury, and it could be very, very expensive. So usually it stops there.
Well, under the TPR, there are defined grounds of unfitness. You have to fit into one of the subsections. If you apply Barstead concept of unfitness here, that need not necessarily comply with all the grounds of a TPR. A person may be unfit, but outside those particular grounds.
I agree, and a person can also become fit, too.
Once TPR is over, it's gone.
That's correct.
I'll tell you how I read the trial court and the Court of Appeals decision. Although you really have to read a lot into it. Namely, these courts recognized a constitutional right in custody cases following Barstead. And no one here is arguing Barstead should be overturned.
Right.
Although there is some indication in some articles that in custody cases, maybe the United States Supreme Court hasn't gone as far as Barstead. Are you familiar with those articles?
No, ma'am, I'm not.
Okay. Then, once you get to where Barstead has a protected constitutional right, then the court is saying that under 880.03, although no one cites that, under 880.03, you have to have extraordinary circumstances to prevent harm. And extraordinary circumstances equal Barstead, one of which is unfitness and compelling circumstances.
Right.
Therefore, there aren't grounds to appoint any guardian here, and you never get to suitability. Now, no one makes that argument, which surprised me.
I'll make it right now.
Good idea. Your time's up.
Thank you.
I have one more question
before
you go.
Justice Robinson.
Sorry.
Aren't the guardian proceedings for whomever, a child or someone that's incompetent or someone that has some other disability, aren't they all geared toward asking the court to protect a proposed ward's either person or property?
Are the guardianships? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so they're protection statutes, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so why would we get
to Chapter 767 standards without first a finding that this particular proposed ward needed protection of the person, which is what we're dealing with here.
I would agree with that statement, and I think it goes to Justice Abrahamson's talking about the extraordinary circumstances, and does that come before the suitability question? And with the extraordinary circumstances, I would agree with your statement if it shows from extraordinary circumstances that there is a need for a guardianship, then I think you get to that issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. White, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. If this court says that unfitness is the standard in a guardianship case, then we may as well do away with the guardianship statute because of the reasons that Justice Prosser had indicated. I believe that the burden is going to be so high if someone were to come into my office, I would probably be saying to them, we can't get this guardianship because we can't show the parent is unfit. I do not believe that the guardianship statute requires unfitness of a parent. If my client had not, in this case, had not been having that child reside with her, travel with her, and she was not concerned about the living arrangements in her great niece's home situation, we wouldn't be here today. I mean, there's always facts that lead to decisions, but that's the truth of the matter. And I think that the guardianship statute is there for a purpose. And I believe that it's there, and I think that the law hasn't proven me wrong yet. This court can make a determination on that. But the guardianship statute does not require the level of proof that a TPR requires or that a custody requires. Because in a custody, as Chief Justice Abramson had alluded to, and Justice Bradley as well, in a custody matter, you're going to have presumptions that are going to have to be overcome once custody is granted. There is nowhere in Chapter 880 where you're going to have to deal with presumptions if you're the parent trying to get the court to say you're not suitable and the children can go back with you. I'm sorry.
I think it's our bench book. The judicial bench book, there are certain elements that the court has to find in an 880 action. And one of those is proposed ward is resident of county and is found in county under extraordinary circumstances requiring medical aid or prevention of harm to person or property. Did you prove that in this case?
Number one, Your Honor, Lamanda McSweeney did not have an attorney in that case, and so I would agree with her counsel now that she did a pretty good job because I lost. But we felt that in the presentation and the entire record that I don't believe was included with this, we felt that we had shown that there were circumstances. Number one, that the great aunt was taking care of the child. And number two, that there were problems that Judge Evenson really doesn't address. And I think Judge Evenson did address this case under 767 standard because he said that's where it belongs. You're gone, you know, and I would say that we feel that we did show extraordinary circumstances when your child is 3 years old and they've resided for a significant portion of time with another person, and we can show that the mother's has a chaotic living arrangement. That's when we look at things and we start to believe that the child might be in danger.
What's missing from this record, counsel?
Well, I'm not sure whether the record includes all of the testimony, because there was testimony taken from the appellant. There was testimony taken from Ms. McSweeney. There was testimony taken from her friends. And the basis of the appeal was that the court simply had misapplied the statute.
Well, you're right. It appears that the only transcript is an excerpt from the hearing on 12-3. And then we have the piece of that in your appendix. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Judge.
As to the court. So what we have does not show any finding of extraordinary circumstance.
We do not have the facts in front of you.
And the court, trial court, didn't find them. Found that she wasn't the best of potential mothers in an ideal or not so ideal world, and that he wasn't going to move her as custodian, in effect.
Just in response to that, Chief Justice Abramson, the trial court wasn't really approaching it from extraordinary circumstances issue, because it didn't feel 880 applied.
Well, and it didn't apply because it was applying Barstad to 880. It was saying that Barstad is a constitutional decision and has to be engrafted in 880.
That I would agree with that, yes.
Okay. So then he said, okay, then you got to find unfitness, which would be part of, and I shouldn't limit it to unfitness, you'd have to have compelling circumstances and the other elements of Barstad. They equal extraordinary circumstances because of the constitutional overlay. That's what he was saying, as I read it. Now, did he say it exactly that way?
Did he say it exactly that way? No, ma'am, he did not, no.
Might have been easier for all of us.
If we just assumed hypothetically that you clearly proved extraordinary circumstances at a hearing in 2003, how do we take the fact that I think the child has been with the mother for the last 2 years? Is that right?
That's basically true, yes. Justice Prosser, that's correct.
And if there has been no CHIPS action, or, I mean, wouldn't that in effect, even if you had a guardianship, had won on a guardianship, wouldn't somehow that have been all neutralized by 2 years?
Well, we can all take a position as to what if something had happened, but in fact, today, you know, I think that this court, in dealing with this case, as Attorney Campbell has said, we've got to come up with a formula, in my estimation. And I just want to close, if I may, Chief Justice Abramson. Barstad says this, and I quote, "Since the interests at stake in a custody dispute are somewhat less than in a termination proceeding, it would be expected that the constitutional standards would also be somewhat lower." And I think that this court's job is to determine for us practitioners, as well as in this particular case, what that guardianship statute says about unfitness. Is unfitness going to be read into the statute? Is it not going to be read in? It's a very important case because we deal, as Attorney Campbell said, day to day with these guardianships. And as I indicated in my opening here rebuttal, we may as well do away with 880 if we find unfitness as the standard. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. White, and thank you, Ms. Campbell, for an excellent discussion today of 880 and 767 in the Constitution. That terminates our hearing in 04AP0767, Robin K. versus Amanda M. The court will take a few moments recess to allow the students to leave and new students, other students, come in, and we'll then hear our second case for today. We're in recess.